Hello, this is Beverly Tomasian. I'd like to welcome you all to our program today, our Diabetes Mini-Series Class 4. I'm really excited about this program because we're going to be talking about a very important aspect of diabetes management, and that's medical nutrition therapy. And we're also going to be talking about lower extremity assessment. So all of these topics are critical to really helping our patients have the best lives possible with diabetes. And I think it's interesting, I'm a registered nurse and a certified diabetes educator, and I'm teaching a program on medical nutrition therapy. But I think this brings up a very excellent point that when you're a certified diabetes educator, you're expected to know about all aspects of diabetes. So if I'm a nurse, I better be very well versed in medical nutrition therapy and pharmacology and a lower extremity assessment. And if I'm a dietitian, I'm going to be comfortable with using a glucose meter and helping with medication adjustments. And if I'm a pharmacist or other healthcare professionals, I'm going to need to know all these different aspects too. So once you are a certified diabetes educator, we're expected to know all of these topics. And you know, at least we need to know the basics about them. And always the best reference point for me is going back to the ADA Standards of Care and our textbooks, Art and Science textbook, to get that baseline information that we need to know. And also, I do want to say that I love hanging out with my colleagues. So I was so blessed and fortunate to team up with registered dietitians throughout much of my career. We would do team classes where we would teach outpatient classes, but also we did group visits where the dietitian and I would get together with like 5 or 6 patients and we meet with them once a week. And it was such a wonderful opportunity to hear how my colleague instructed. And then working with pharmacists, also hearing how they teach about medications. So if you're thinking about moving into this field and becoming a certified diabetes educator, or if you already are one and you want to kind of get more familiar with these topics, ask your colleagues, can I hang out with you for the day and hear what you do? And since they do it all the time, they have this amazing expertise and ability to wrap words or to put concepts into understandable words. Because a lot of time as healthcare professionals, I find one of the hardest things to do is take all this complex information about the science, the pathophysiology of diabetes, and translate it into English. I've been working on it for 20 years. How do I reach out to my patients and really make this information understandable in their life, given their life experiences? And, of course, our best teachers are our patients because we'll listen to the language they use and how they understand their world. But our colleagues are fantastic, too. So I'm just going to assume you have the handout. The handout is in the resource section under a Diabetes Online mini-series, and you can print that out. And let's get going because we have a lot to cover today. We're going to be talking about the new nutrition guidelines. So in 2013, the American Diabetes Association put out new medical nutrition therapy guidelines. And I think there were some really interesting changes that were made, and some of the things remained the same. So I'm going to be going over what's new and what's the same. We're also going to be discussing keeping it real for our patients. As we talk about nutrition therapy and food, it's a very sensitive topic. Let's just be honest. There's a lot of people have emotional relationships with food. They have cultural, you know, history with their food. Food is a time of gathering and pleasure. And so we have to be very onerous and respect people's beliefs around food and let them make those small changes and let them be the leader in changing the way they eat. And then we're also going to talk about a quick and effective foot assessment. So now, one of my favorite slides out there. I don't know if any of you have ever felt like shooting the scale, but my colleague, she's a dietitian, she goes, sometimes I want to shoot it with 2 guns, not just 1. And so, you know, weight is a struggle. If we look around America, we know that, you know, 70% of our of people in America are overweight or obese, 70%. And so that scale is not going in the right direction, and our patients get really frustrated. As diabetes educators and advocates, we're going to really help them understand their relationship with food and make some changes to help succeed with weight loss and also with eating more nutritious foods too. So what I'd like to do, like I always do, is ask you a few questions to get started and just to kind of ask you, how many calories does the average American consume a day in general? If you were to interview a million people, what would be the general caloric intake of people in a year in America? Thank you so much for voting, everybody. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll, and I'm going to share it with all of you. So 61% of you chose 2,600 calories a day. Well, let's talk about that, because you know what? You are right. It is 2,600 calories a day. And on my past newsletter, there was an article called Obesity and Economics. It's one of the best articles in obesity I've ever read, and it really dissected why we're getting heavier. And one of the reasons is we used to eat about 30 years ago about 2,000 calories a day. We're up to 2,600 calories a day. And, you know, we're spending less time cooking and preparing. The average woman used to spend 2 hours a day preparing meals and cleaning in the kitchen. That number has gone way down. So you can see as we're consuming more calories, the weight of the nation is increasing. Let me ask you one more question. Which of the following is true about medical nutrition therapy? And you can actually choose more than one answer. Which of the following is true about medical nutrition therapy? Okay, great job, everyone. Yeah, there's actually three answers that are correct. You guys are on fire today, that's all I can say. It's looking really good. Let me close this and share this with you. You're absolutely right. Medical nutrition therapy is wildly effective at lowering A1Cs. It can lower it by 1 to 2 percentage points. So 1% of A1C is about 30, so that means it drops blood sugar 30 to 60 points. It is an opportunity to provide positive messages about food. Patients are bombarded with a lot of erroneous information about food, and there's all these reports coming out all the time. They are so confused. So we have an opportunity to really set the record straight. And I always come back to evidence-based information, and I will tell patients, I get my information from the American Dietetic Association, from the American Diabetes Association. It's based in evidence. It's based in science, and I give them those websites. And 95% of you also chose EAT. It provides the patients with practical choices. Yes, so that's why we do a food recall. We ask the patients, tell me what you eat during the day. When do you eat breakfast, lunch, or dinner? Or when is your first meal of the day? And so we're going to take that information and not wildly change what they do, but build upon that, keep what's working well for them, and with their permission, make small changes in helping them improve based on their goals. So I'm always asking patients, is one of your goals to lose weight? And if it is, we'll work on that. So I'm going to base it on their goals, but I'm always keeping in mind that I know weight loss is very important for lowering blood sugars. I'm going to ask you one more question. Well, I'm actually going to ask you two more. According to the new ADA guidelines, how much fiber should the Americans eat a day? I think there's some dietitians in the audience. This is what I'm thinking. Or maybe you all have read the medical nutrition therapy guidelines and know the fiber goal. Excellent job, everybody. All right. Most of you have voted. I'm going to go ahead and close this and share with you. So 90% of you got the right answer without any hesitation. 25 to 38 grams of fiber a day. That's a lot of fiber. And if you look at labels, just start looking at labels and seeing, you know, how much does this piece of bread have as far as fiber? Whatever you're eating, and see if you're even getting close to this. This is hard to achieve, and that's why we always keep talking about vegetables, whole grains, fruits, great sources of fiber for our patients. Okay, I'm going to do one more, then I will move on. But this is good. I'm glad we're talking about all of this. How many calories are in 1 pound? That is, if I want to lose a pound, how many calories do I have to deprive myself of? Ooh, that's a hard word. But when we talk about weight loss, many times we do talk about calorie deprivation. I don't like using that word with my patients because deprivation and deprive and diabetes oftentimes don't go that well together because they're already feeling like you're taking everything away from me. But I will say to lose a pound, you need to eat 3,500 calories less a day. Oh, I just gave the answer away. Let me share that with you. So you 80% of you got that right, and most of you have voted. So now let's just talk about what that means, 3,500 calories. So if a sandwich on average is 500 calories, that would mean you would have to eat 7 sandwiches less to lose a pound. Weight loss is not easy. Weight loss is not easy. And while I'm on the topic of weight loss, we'll talk about this more. Generally speaking, exercise doesn't cause weight loss. And lots of studies support this. So if I'm just walking a half hour a day, it's not going to cause weight loss unless I'm eating less. But it will help sustain weight loss. It's going to help lower my visceral adiposity. It's going to help burn blood sugars. But a lot of patients think, well, if I take a walk, I'll lose weight. But I don't want them to think that. It says, A, it's not true. And B, sometimes they think, well, if I walk, I can eat a little bit more. No. You know, because I'm exercising more. We don't want to give that message across. We want people to succeed. So losing weight is really a combination of eating less and maintaining activity. And that's what I think it makes it really hard. Okay, well, let's get going. So a lot of the concepts I've asked you about are going to appear in these slides here, so we've already discussed these. But you can see obesity in America, and this is from that article, and I will put this article as a reference on your resource page. It's so excellent. But weight has gone up regardless of college degree. So it is true, people with college education weigh less in general. Their BMI is a little bit less than people with less than a high school education. But even the college education people are gaining weight. So this is scary because we're all gaining weight over time, and our BMI is going up, our average BMI, regardless of income, of profession, all of that. And you can see here calories per day. In the 1970s, we were around 2,000, and now we're up to 2,600. And so 68% of our people are overweight or obese. Now, this is an important fact. 1/3 of all overweight people don't get diabetes. So patients may say to me, well, Bev, I got diabetes because I'm overweight or obese. The truth is you have to have the gene. So there's many people who never get diabetes who are morbidly obese because they don't have the genetics. So it's a combination. Diabetes is a combination of your genetics, body weight, activity, and your age. It all goes together. It is true that we're less active at work, and as a matter of fact, I think about this a lot. My grandmother raised nine children. She didn't really sit down much at all during the day. And that was just a generation ago, well, two generations ago. But our generation of people sit on average 9 hours a day. 9 hours a day we're sitting. So you'll hear people say sitting is the new smoking. We're just so much more sedentary. The other thing is that food costs less. Before, in the old days, food was a lot more of the income. Maybe about 20% of the income was due to food expense. But now it's down. So because of this, people are eating more. So food is more accessible and it's cheaper. So people are having higher caloric intakes. Here's a really interesting visual image of BMI. And I love this slide because it really gives you an idea, because we always talk about BMI 25 or greater is considered overweight. And so you can see BMI 18 to 25 looks like this. But once we start getting over 25, there's a lot more visceral and thigh adiposity. These are women. But this visceral adiposity is dangerous because patients are getting more insulin resistant with that as they gain weight around the waist area. So that's a really big problem. As we gain that weight, that visceral fat causes us to have higher levels of blood sugar and also be more resistant to the insulin that we do make. So I think this is a very effective BMI chart, and you can just Google BMI chart visual image, and that came up for me right away. So I just thought I'd share it with you. This other shocking piece of news, I don't know if I brought it up in previous webinars, but I can't get over it. I can't believe this is true, that the average American consumes about 25 teaspoons of sugar a day. 25 teaspoons, which is an extra 400 calories. What are we doing to stop the tide of sugar in the foods? Well, I don't know. California tried to put a warning label on sodas. It got nixed by the Congress. Congress said, no, you can't do that. And the warning label was going to say soda intake has been associated with increased rates of diabetes and obesity. One soda has 12 teaspoons. So even the American Diabetes Association now says, avoid sodas. Sodas have a lot of sugar in them and can, cause elevations in blood sugar and body weight. But look at this. On average, one person consumes 40 gallons of soda a year. Yikes. And so one of our first questions we're going to ask our patients with diabetes is, are you drinking soda or sugary beverages? And then we're going to start the negotiation process and say, you know what, I'm concerned about those because they can really contribute to, body weight and also contribute to higher levels of sugar in your blood. Would you be willing or would you consider cutting back on those? And that's how we're going to open this conversation. And I'm going to always bring their goals to light. Like, oh, you said one of your goals was to lose weight, or one of your goals was to get your blood sugar to target. Would you be willing to make this change? And, one-on-one counseling is really important, teaching our patients one-on-one. I meet with, lots of patients one-on-one. But truly, this is from Dr. Frieden of the CDC. The only real way to reduce the prevalence of obesity is through community action. And I think that's really such an excellent point, that we can do one-on-one counseling and talk to people about nutrition, but we need to take it to the community. And I think about when my kids go to church sometimes and they're like all excited because, they serve donuts and Kool-Aid after the service. And I'm thinking, as a society, can we transform that? And when we have office parties, instead of, providing high-calorie foods, can we share nutritional foods? Little things like that, making statements whenever we can about the health that we provide our people, the foods we provide our people, can make such a big difference. In one community, they just reduced the size of the plates in the restaurants. They just said, restaurants, please reduce your plate size. It was a voluntary action. But that community lost weight. We can make a difference. We can make a difference. Here's McDonald's, and there was a really excellent study I read that if you live closer to a fast food restaurant within a half a mile, or your kid's school is within a half a mile of a restaurant, that group of people is heavier. They weigh more because they frequent these restaurants more frequently. Now, I just want to compare these two foods. Here's in the old days when people used to get, regular burger with soda and French fries. And this was, when I was a kid going out to McDonald's, it was a huge treat for us. We were pretty limited on income, so it was a big deal. But here you can see this meal, a regular meal, is 627 calories. Now, if you supersize it over here, look how many calories this is, 1,800. So that's almost your total caloric needs in one meal. And look at how this is as far as fat, 84 grams of fat. That is not the good fat. That's not the fat that makes you happy. That is that saturated, nasty fat. And our people don't know this, and they're eating it. So I think bringing this awareness is very, very important. And I do say, I have a lot of patients who eat fast food. And I'll say, if that's a choice you want to make, let's talk about some healthier choices you can make when you eat fast food. And we go over this. And I would say instead of supersizing everything, go back to regular size. Maybe instead of getting French fries, or if you do get French fries, eat half. Throw the rest away. Try to avoid cheese and mayonnaise and a lot of extra sauce on your burger. And don't get the regular soda. Try and get iced tea. So within that, we can help them make some healthier changes. And then, asking them to reflect on after they eat these foods, how do they feel? Because a lot of patients don't feel that good after they eat these foods. So having them get more in touch with their bodies, too, and reflecting on that. So as diabetes educators, we are reaching out and finding out a lot of personal information. Eating habits are very personal. So we're going to, identify what's working, what's not working, and help that patient make the decision themselves to make some changes. The other thing I do want to mention, there's been a lot of research lately on gut bacteria. So I really believe that there's something more than just calories in and energy out that's causing our obesity epidemic. I think there's environmental factors that we don't really understand yet. And certainly one of those environmental factors are influencing our gut bacteria. So there's a lot of studies now looking at the gut bacteria and saying, how does that relate to diabetes and obesity? This brand new study, which was reported out at the International Endocrine Meeting, was very compelling. What they did at this meeting is they got a lot of patients, over about 100 patients, and 27 of them were morbidly obese, 26 of them had new type 2, and 28 were healthy controls. And they actually just did stool samples on a regular basis, and they looked at their stools, and they said, what kind of bacteria are in their stools? This is so interesting. The Firmicutes, they had a 4% lower rate or amount in obese patients, 13% lower in people with diabetes. The bifidobacteria, 14% lower in obese patients, 28% lower in those with diabetes. The Clostridium leptum, 14% lower in obese patients, 11% lower in those with diabetes. So maybe the lack of these certain types of bacteria increase the risk or are associated with increased risk of obesity and diabetes. And the question then is, how do we get more healthy bacteria into our intestines? How do we do that? Well, definitely fibrous foods, vegetables, artichokes, tomatoes, garlic, they all help to improve our gut bacteria. And there's also, you know, probiotics, so the yogurts and the other pickled or fermented types of foods tend to have a lot of good bacteria in there. And so what I'm saying is we've changed the way we're eating. We're eating less good bacteria because we're eating more processed and packaged foods that are sterile. And so we're depriving our bodies of these friends. I love what this woman said. The human gut microbiome consists of 100 trillion bacteria or some 100 trillion friends you didn't know you had. I love that because truly humans have evolved to have a symbiotic relationship with bacteria. We need them. They help us. They help us fight disease. They help us keep in balance. And what we've done is we over-sanitized everything, and there's something called the hygiene hypothesis where we've eliminated a lot of the bacteria that help us. And so I just want to put that out there. And if you want to learn more about this very exciting topic, which I think is really intriguing, I do teach these free webcasts in addition to what I'm teaching today on, it's called New Frontiers. So the New Frontiers, I talk about gut bacteria and how that might affect our health and our risk of diabetes. Okay, so thanks so much. Let's keep talking about the new guidelines then. So these are Medical Nutrition Therapy ADA 2014 update. It was updated in 2013, but they reaffirmed it in 2014. And on your resources page, you'll see I have the Medical Nutrition Therapy updated guidelines there. You can download them and read them. But here's some critical points. There's no ideal percentage of calories from protein, carbohydrate, and fat for people with diabetes. Okay. That doesn't seem very helpful because before we used to say, well, about 20% of calories from fat, 20% from protein, 50% from carb, 30% from fat. But they're saying there's no magic formula. We have to individualize it based on the patient. And so if the patient comes in with high LDL cholesterol and high triglycerides and, you know, their cholesterol panel isn't looking that good, we might focus more on fats and carbohydrates. But we also need to look at kidney function. So maybe that would, you know, influence our recommendations around protein. So we're going to individualize what we say to our patients. So listen to this. Macronutrient distribution should be based on individualized assessment of eating patterns, preferences, and goals. Again, that individualized. So I love this second bullet point. Maintain the pleasure of eating. Focus on the individual. I remember when I first started in diabetes education, I'm sure many of you also remember this, we would give a tear sheet and say, here's all the food you cannot eat. And then the patient could not eat Jell-O pudding, cakes, pies, donuts, you know, anything with sugar. Don't put sugar in your coffee. It was all about deprivation. And we realized that wasn't based in evidence. So now we're saying, Tell me the food you love to eat. Let's incorporate it into your meal plan. And let's provide those positive messages about food. I love this. Limit food choices only when backed by science. So a lot of times the patients will come to me, and I know you've heard this, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. My doctor told me I can't eat any white foods, or I can't eat any fruit, or I can't eat potatoes. And there's all this mythology out there, not really based on evidence. So we want to get back to the evidence with our patients, and I will say, I hear your doctor saying that. Let me just show you some of the information from the American Diabetes Association. And I just try and not overwhelm them or contradict their provider, but just really supply them with another viewpoint. Okay, here's sodium, fat, and fiber. This is new. And we used to have different guidelines on sodium for people with diabetes, but now we say just like the general population, less than 2,300 milligrams a day. So maybe not having the salt shaker at the dinner table. But I just want to say something, because we used to say that a lot, and I actually want to rescind that comment. It's not usually the salt shaker at the dinner table that throws people over on their sodium. It's the processed food. It's the fast food. It's the, you know, the chips. Those have a lot of salt in them. So if we eat whole fresh foods, we're eating a lot less salt. Really, vitamin and mineral supplementation, not recommended. There's no good evidence. And then fat. Look at this. This is new. Same as recommended for the general population. For saturated fat, it used to say less than 7%. It says less than 10%. Unless they have high LDL cholesterol, then we might say let's shoot for a little bit lower target of 7%. For all people, limit trans fats, you know, cholesterol 300 milligrams. And they do talk about Mediterranean diet looking like a good option in the nutrition therapy guidelines. So you can take a look at that. And then here's our fiber recommendation. So the approach really depends on the patient, and I know you, as you do this over and over again, you really realize some patients want a lot of information with strict guidelines. Some patients want a very comprehensive meal plan. What do I eat? Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Some people need that. And some people are like, just give me general ideas. I can deal with that. And some people, you're just working with them not to maybe bring junk food into the house. So it really depends on where they're at and in your conversation with them. And so they have new type 2 portion control. This is all from the ADA standards. Plate method, keeping a record. Record keeping, one of the best ways to change the way you eat. If you document everything you eat, drink, and put into your mouth, just by documenting it, you eat less unhealthy foods. And what I'm asking my patients to do more recently is take photos of your meals. Isn't that interesting? So many of my patients have a phone. Take a picture of your food and go ahead and just document that. Keep taking photos so you have a documentation of your week worth of meals. Wow, great learning opportunity. Now, if they're on insulin, it changes the game plan a little bit. We're going to have to talk more in detail about carbs, because if you take insulin, you have to eat carbohydrates. That's very important. And we might actually have them do some postprandial checks. So what they're going to need to do is, if they're starting on insulin new, check their blood sugar 2 hours afterward. And if a patient, of course, is on intensive insulin therapy, they're going to be on very intensive carbohydrate counting and adjustment of insulin based on carbs and postprandial checks. This is really important. The new studies are showing that when patients are newly diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, if they can lose 2 to 8 kilograms early in diagnosis, so that's about 5 to 17 pounds, a little bit more, it can make a big difference. There's something magic about losing weight early on that protects the beta cells. So when I meet with my patients now, I really talk about this. I say, you know what? We know from science that losing about 5 pounds can really make a difference in protecting your beta cells and helping your pancreas work a lot better. And I just want to share that with you. And it really kind of inspires patients. We're like, really? I'm like, yes. And, you know, we want to protect your beta cells because we want to help them produce as much insulin as possible throughout your lifetime. that's just a good little key to mention with patients. And here again, I'm talking about how do we lose 1 pound? 3,500 calories, you have to eat less. And then you could just say maybe you eat 250 calories less a day. That's a half a pound a week. Some patients are like, man, I don't want to just lose a half pound a week. That's going to drive me crazy. Okay, well, let's try a pound a week. Then you have to eat 3,500 calories less, which is about 500 calories a day. So we do a lot of negotiations around that. And I always try and look for the easy things first, the chips, the snacks, the sodas. Is there things that are not that important to you that you could give up? And we can see some pretty quick weight loss. Okay, don't look at this slide for a second because I want to ask you another question. Which of the following, and you can choose more than one, are successful weight loss strategies? Okay, thank you everyone. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it with you. So, 45% of you said weigh once a week. That is true. The studies show that not weighing every day, but weighing once a week really helps people to succeed at weight loss. So if my patients don't have a scale and they're trying to lose weight, I might suggest that, or they can come to my clinic and weigh themselves. But that once a week weigh-in seems to help people. So that's right. Eat breakfast, yes. Another thing that seems to help people with weight loss, eating that first meal of the day. And then what about meal replacements? This is interesting. Like if you ask me, Beverly, do you think meal replacements are a good idea? Philosophically, I really rather have people eat food because I think that that's a better choice to learn how to eat food and prepare healthy meals. But the fact is some of our patients need a little bit more than that. Meal replacement, so this just means a liquid drink, Slim Fast or some other liquid calorically controlled drink. If they eat two meals a day, regular food and one meal replacement, patients tend to have more success with weight loss. I just want to put that out there. So that's an option for patients who are really struggling. So all three, A, B, and C, tend to help people with weight loss. And so we're learning more, man. You know what? It's one of the hardest things to do is to lose weight. But here's from the American Diabetes Association. I just copied it out of their practice guidelines and their evidence-based information. So you can see I've listed them all here. But these are things that we know work and that can help people to lose that weight. I went to the Diabetes Prevention Program training, and this is a program that is CDC funded and it's been rigorously studied. We know it works. We know people lose weight on this program and they have less chance of getting diabetes because of these changes. But you know what they focused on in this program? It wasn't calories per se or carbs or anything like that. It was fat. And what they said is based on your body weight and your calorie goals, just watch how much fat you eat. Try and stick within these guidelines. They didn't even differentiate between saturated fat or mono or polyunsaturated. No, just total fat per day based on your body weight. And they have great success with weight loss. And so I just want to put that out there as another tool that we can use to help patients succeed at weight loss. And I love this poster. And this is from Choose Health LA. You can go to their website. They have other posters. But we definitely know that to weigh less, you want to choose less. And this is an excellent example of saying you don't have to stop doing it completely, but what you need to do is just eat less of it. And I think this is a wonderful photo that gets people started and thinking about just eating less, even if it's not the healthiest food. It's a start, right? It's a start. That's what we're always trying to do, just make those small changes. And so how do nutrients affect blood sugar? And a lot of my patients don't understand this. And I would just say, to really help patients understand, I had a woman come in to see me the other day, And she has a lot of low blood sugar. So she goes, every time I have a low blood sugar, I make sure and I have avocado or I'll have a meatball. Okay. And so I go, actually, I just want to let you know that protein foods like meat or fat, like avocado, don't raise your blood sugar. She was like, really? I'm like, yes. So if you have a low blood sugar, you want to eat a carbohydrate. And then I explained what those were, you know, gave her examples of those. So I just want to let you know that many times patients are uninformed or misinformed. And I will often say to them the following, if the food had a mother, it won't raise your blood sugar. And they go, what? And so what I'm trying to get at, you know, if it's a dairy product or a protein or a fat, it won't raise your blood sugar. And most of the foods that did have a mother also have saturated fat. So it's another teaching point. So you can see here, carbohydrates will start raising the blood sugar within 15 minutes. And within an hour or so, that peak is on its way down. And that's why we ask patients to check their blood sugar 1 to 2 hours after a meal to see how it affected them postprandially. I do want to say one thing about protein. There were some studies that actually indicated that protein does stimulate the pancreas to make insulin. That's interesting. So, you know, that's just something to keep in mind for your patients. Okay, so teaching about eating healthy, we have different strategies we can use. We can talk about major food groups like protein, fats, carbohydrate. We can do handy diet, plate method, exchange lists, food diaries, carb counting. There's a million different ways to do this. Let me just talk about some of these. And so one thing I do share with my patients is this picture. It's kind of a very basic, simple picture, but I think it gets the point across. And I say move toward the tomato. So on the continuum of food, to the left here, we have the junk food, the sodas, the hamburgers, the Twinkies. And actually, I should put a picture of Little Debbie in there. Little Debbie, as you know, has all those snack cakes and snack foods. And I had a patient who came in to see me, and he goes, I'm eating Little Debbie every day. I love Little Debbie snacks. And I said, you know, John, that wasn't his name. I go, John, would you be willing to break up with Little Debbie? So he's like, really? I have to break up with her? I'm like, I'm just asking you, would you be willing to, you know, stop this relationship? I don't think it's that good for you. And so the next time, we were kind of joking around about it, but the next time I saw him, he walked in, he goes, I broke up with Little Debbie. And it's kind of funny, but it's kind of true because there's a lot of research now backing up, you know, sugar addiction, and people are looking for these foods. They satisfy a lot of desires, you know, the salt, the fat, the sugar. We search for it, especially if we're eating it frequently. And people often tell me as they move toward the tomato, I didn't realize how sweet an apple was, or I didn't realize how delicious a tomato was. Their mouth then starts really getting reacclimated to fresh fruits and vegetables and the taste of natural things. And so I just really like to talk about this with patients. And the other thing I do say is, you know, I talk about the potential of eating 2 nights a week no meat, having a meatless meal, because meat does, you know, have saturated fat, and also it does seem to cause some inflammation in the intestines, and there's some great studies that support that. And if they're already having elevated blood sugar levels and they have metabolic syndrome, I'm just going to explore that idea with them. Would you be willing to eat a plant-based dinner twice a week? See what happens. It's a lot more fiber usually and better nutrition. Okay, I have a picture of coffee here. Why? Interestingly enough, many studies have come out lately saying drinking 2 cups of coffee a day can reduce your chance of getting diabetes by 30%. So if you don't have diabetes and you drink 2 cups of coffee, it seems to be really helpful. And so I just put that out there in the universe for those of us who are coffee drinkers, that you might be doing a good thing for yourself. A lot of my patients ask me, Bev, should I stop drinking coffee? I have diabetes. I'm like, there is no evidence to support you not drinking coffee. There is no evidence. But people think when they have diabetes, they can't have coffee. I have not read that to be the case at all. It's what we put in our coffee that's a problem. But seriously, what if they put 1 teaspoon of sugar? It's 5 grams of carbohydrate. It's okay. Let it, you know, enjoy the coffee. So ADA recommendation, eat less junk food and sugary drinks. So how do we, you know, encourage our community to drink healthier beverages? And look at this. This is the ADA. Sugary beverages seem to increase that visceral adiposity, and that's beverages with sugar or high fructose corn syrup. And, you know, Mayor Bloomberg from New York, I know he's no longer the mayor of New York, but he was a tremendous public health advocate, in my opinion. And everybody gave him a lot of trouble because it says right here, New York to ban soft drinks larger than 16 ounces. So here's a picture of a guy getting two 12 ounces and, you know, slurping it up. Forget about it. But Mayor Bloomberg realized, you know, there's an obesity epidemic and we need to do something about it. So he was trying to help through legislation to help people be more conscious of the food they're eating. And there is legislation that's come up recently for a soda tax and a junk food tax. And I think these are something to think about because we definitely know when we put the cigarette tax and we really hiked up the prices of cigarettes, people smoke less. As a matter of fact, the rate has dropped tremendously since that cigarette tax was initiated. And so I'm just kind of throwing it out there as we're thinking about this epidemic and what we can do, just some strategies. But I also give this handout to my patients, and they really love it. And I say, these are 10 superfoods. I want you to incorporate these foods into your meal plan. And I just copied these superfoods from the American Diabetes Association website, and I just made my own little handout. But look at this, beans, dark green leafy vegetables, citrus fruit, sweet potatoes. So many patients say, I can't eat sweet potatoes. You know, they're so high in sugar. I'm like, they're great for you. Those dark orange vegetables offer a lot. So enjoy them, but just count the carbohydrates in them. Berries, tomatoes, fish high in omega-3 fatty acids, whole grains, nuts, and fat-free milk and yogurt. So these are foods we want to steer our patients toward. And, of course, if they're trying to manage their weight, watch out for nuts because a handful of nuts is a serving. I'm not talking of two hands put together, like a little handful of nuts. They are very calorie-dense, but the nuts offer so much as far as fiber, satiation, and, you know, nutrients. They really are a good source of protein and nutrition for our patients. So here's the food pyramid. Well, it's the choosemyplate.gov. So I'm sorry, I need to change my slide to match this, but this was the modified version of the pyramid, and now it says choose my plate. And the concepts behind this I really appreciate. I don't use this to teach much. I'll show you a plate that I use. It matches my beliefs and my ideas better. So this is interesting because the patients bring belief and we bring beliefs and ideas about food, right? So we both have different perspectives on food. We have to find somewhere to meet. But I love what they say over here. Enjoy your food, but eat less. Watch out for oversized portions. So that's, again, getting back to the plate size. In Japan, they actually invented glasses that enlarges your food, so it looks like you're eating more. Well, that's an idea because we are visual eaters. If we think there's more, we'll eat more. I mean, we'll eat. If we feel like there's more, we feel more satiated. But instead, just get a smaller plate. It's cheaper. Make half your plate fruits and vegetables. Really go toward the whole grains, low-fat or fat-free milk, and then watch for sodium, and drink water instead of sugary drinks. I love this. I had a patient, you know, I said, what are some good beverages we can, you know, drink? What are some good choices? And this, and then this patient brought up water, and the patient goes, is water a beverage? And I'm like, yes, water is a beverage. We've been relying on water for a long time, humankind, and it's very, it's the best, you know, fluid source for our body. Water's terrific. And so here's another plate example that I like a little bit better because half of it is veggies. I love this. Half veggies, you know, lots of salad and fresh fruit and, I mean, fresh vegetables. And then we have some arroz y frijoles, so beans and rice. And it says here 1/4 serving of starch. And then we have our protein. And, of course, that protein size is about the size of the palm of your hand. This is in Spanish, but the same plate comes up in English. Look at this. I love this. They measure the plate size, 9 inches. Wow. So they're not only saying here's a way to nourish yourself, but look at your plate size too. And I love the other plate has a glass of milk. This has water. This is why I like this picture better. And another thing about it is the serving of fruits on the side. And that looks like a beautiful dessert to me. So I would just Google, if I was you, plates, meals and healthy plates, examples, and a lot of stuff comes up, and you can find a plate that matches you. And that is, you know, based on science, of course. But here's another plate that I just found, and our last newsletter was on mindful eating. The mindful eating plate. So this is very, very important to keep in mind as patients are struggling with weight loss. One of the strategies that patients can use to help lose weight is to be more mindful when they eat. And so, yeah, I talk a lot to my patients about nutrition and healthy eating and so forth, but what about their relationship with food? And I think that's one aspect that's not addressed that often, but it really needs to be addressed. Because as you know, a lot of our patients with diabetes, or many of them have disordered eating or they're binge eating. And how do we stop that cycle? So this might be a way to approach it that's safe for them. And the first thing is awareness. Are we really tasting or just mindless munching? We all know about this because I'm guilty of this, and I'm really working hard on being more mindful when I eat, really being present with my food, noticing the flavor, the texture, the aroma, being non-judgmental. This is interesting. Speaking mindfully and compassionately, notice when shoulds or rigid rules of guilt pop into your mind. Are we giving ourselves permission to enjoy our food? Are we in the moment, or are we watching TV or working at our computer? And are we observing? I love this. We had a guest speaker talk on mindful eating yesterday for our support group, and I found it very interesting when she was talking about fullness. How do you know when you're full? Your body will tell you. Listen to your body. And, you know, it does take 20 minutes to get the fullness notice to your body, to your mind. So you can eat a lot of food in 20 minutes. But she brought up this really good point. Notice when you're full, and then you can stop eating. Notice when you're hungry, and that's a good time to start eat. And really trying to avoid eating when you're stressed out. So it's not just what type of food we choose to eat. It's also our relationship with food. And remember that it's nourishing our body. So I'm going to start using this when I talk to patients who are really struggling with food. The other thing I want to just look at is a food label with all of you. So we know, you know, looking at food labels is perplexing for patients. It's confusing. They don't know what to look at. And actually, there's a new food label that's coming out. Hopefully, it will be approved next year. It's clearer. It's more clear and helps patients navigate this a little bit better. But let's just take a look at this. Here's a half cup, and there's 4 servings in a container. And then, so I want the patients to know what is one serving, how many servings per container. And the next thing I want them to look at is total carbohydrate. So this, for half a cup, is about 1 serving of carbohydrate. We're going to look at fiber, too, because remember, we have a goal for fiber. If this says less than 1 gram of fiber, it is a low-fiber food. So 3 grams, I'm feeling pretty positive about. And if I ate all 4 servings, I'd be getting 12 grams. So this seems like a pretty decent food. And I also want to look at the fat. So I'm looking at total fat, but also saturated fat. I want the saturated fat to be low, so it's 0, which is terrific. Now the sugars. Patients always get confused on sugars. And I usually tell them, well, that sugar gram is just a part of the total carbohydrate. So it counts, and the total carbohydrate already accounts for that. But I'm going to bring up something that I've been noticing lately. Is that this sugar is what is called added sugar. It's not sugar naturally occurring in the food. It's sugar that they've added. And I was eating oatmeal. I thought it was such a healthy oatmeal. And I looked at the sugar just the other day, and it had 24 grams of sugar. And if you know that 1 teaspoon of sugar is 4 grams, they were adding 6 teaspoons of sugar to that oatmeal, 6 teaspoons. And so this is the educational point I bring to patients. this is okay. This is 3 grams of sugar. It's less than a teaspoon. That's okay. But if it's adding, you know, 4 and 5 and 6 teaspoons of sugar, that's a lot. So that's what that number means. And that's the significance of it. It's that white sugar they add on. And if you look at yogurt, holy mackerel, there's a lot of sugar added to yogurt. I do want to point out an app, and I use this app a lot because I have kids that are 9 and 12 years of age, and we go shopping together, and then we're going down the cereal aisle, which is the most deadly aisle of all in any shopping experience. And, of course, they're always wanting to get the junk food cereals. And I go, okay, I've downloaded this app called Fujicate, and what you can do is it has a scanning mechanism, and you can scan the food, and it will give you a grade. And so I go, you can only get cereals that are B-plus or better. So it just takes the argument out, and then they can scan it and see, and it has educational information. This is a free app, and I find it very, very useful. I'm sure many of you have other apps you've used, and if you want to email me later some apps, I'd love to share that with everybody. But this is just one example of how technology can really help patients understand, have a better understanding of what's in their food. Okay, let's talk about carbs a little bit more. And in this picture, there's a lot of starchy foods out there, and they're going to affect the post-meal blood glucose level. So we definitely know that carbohydrates are the foods that influence post-meal blood glucose the most. And I've listed this here not as an ADA guideline or a medical nutrition therapy guideline that is written in stone. It's just a getting started place. Sometimes patients ask me, how many grams of carbohydrate can I eat per meal? And this is where I'm going to start with them. And if they want a definition of how much to eat per meal, this is a getting started place. Of course, these numbers vary based on body weight, activity level, blood sugars, all of that stuff. But generally speaking, like a thin woman would need around 45 grams of carb per meal. A gentleman, 60 grams. Maybe if he's, you know, large and very active, 75, 90 grams per meal. But generally speaking, for most people, this is the range, which is 3 to 4 servings. And then for their snacks, it's about 15 to 30 grams for each snack. So if they're trying to lose weight, I'm going to, you know, error more on the 15 grams of carbohydrate per meal. I'm sorry, per snack. So let me say that again. If I'm trying to help them lose weight, for their snacks, we're going to try and stick to 15 grams per snack. I just want to say something else. Sometimes when I'm teaching patients about how much carbs to have per meal, for some reason they misinterpret it and they think it's per day. So I really go over that a lot. I'm not saying 45 to 60 grams per day. It's per meal. Very important to make sure they understand that. So let's talk about some healthy carbs that people can eat. I love this picture of this vegetable fruit face. It's so terrific. But we definitely know that healthy carbs are the carbs that are healthiest, have fiber, vitamins, minerals, phytonutrients, and we're trying to get to that 25 grams of fiber a day. Power carbs, superfoods, you hear this a lot. Which foods are those? Beans. I'm really in love with beans because they're very inexpensive, lots of fiber, great nutrition, and I'm also in love with quinoa. Quinoa is just a wonderful grain that really has a lot of protein in it and a lot of other nutrients. So that's not on this slide, but beans, veggies, fruits, whole grain foods. That's where we want our patients to go toward. There's one strategy I've used in the past, and this might work for you. So I'll say, listen, if you're trying to figure out how much carbs to have per meal, you can use a handy meal plan. And the handy meal plan says each finger is 15 grams of carbs. So you have 4 fingers, you can have 4 servings of carb per meal. Or if you're a woman, you just have 3 servings, but your fingers remind you of how many carb servings per meal. The palm of your hand reminds you about how much protein. So it's 3 ounces of protein. I really want patients to get in touch with how much protein they're eating, because a lot of patients who are eating meat are eating, you know, 7-8 ounce steaks or big hunks of meat, and that increases caloric intake and also can affect their lipid levels. So we really want to talk about serving size of protein and then fat. So this is the added fat, you know, the mayonnaise, the salad dressing, but 1 teaspoon of fat is a serving, and that's the tip of your finger of your thumbnail. The tip of your thumbnail. So if the patients can really be conscious of this and kind of look at how much they're eating using this handy meal plan, it is another good weight loss strategy too. It can really, really help patients. But I do go over this. If patients are on insulin, if they want to know more about carb counting, I'm going to let them take the lead and I'm going to follow what they want to know. So this to me is more detailed information. I'm not going to go over this with every patient. I'm going to go over it with those patients who want that more detailed information and who are on insulin therapy and really need to understand what carbohydrates are and how much is one serving. And so you can see here, oh, hang on 1 second. Don't look at that handout. Okay. Which of the following are examples of 15 grams of carb? And you can choose more than one. Okay, most of you voted. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share with you. So you can choose more than one. So it is true that a small apple is a serving of carbohydrate. And I do go over that a lot with my patients. They ask me, can I have fruit? And I'm saying, yes, but you want to get a small piece of fruit. So I always say to them, close your hand and make a fist. That is about the size of a small piece of fruit. So they need to get in touch with portion and how much is small. That's a really important notion to get across. So that's the right answer. What about a half cup of Jell-O? Only 40%. Oh, let me pop this up so you all can see. 40% of you chose that. Half a cup of Jell-O is one serving of carbohydrate or 15 grams. So if you're in the hospital setting, you might notice that people with diabetes are getting Jell-O as part of their clear liquid diet. It's okay. A half a cup of Jell-O is 15 grams of carbohydrate. Patients can eat that and enjoy it. It's all right. It's one serving. Also, a half a cup of ice cream is one serving, 15 grams. Okay, so that's correct. Let's see. A cup of pasta, 20% of you chose this. This is actually, one cup of pasta is 3 servings of carbohydrate. 1 cup of pasta. So 1/3 cup of pasta is 1 serving. So remember, so 1 serving is 15 grams. So if you have 1 cup of pasta, you just are eating 45 grams of carbohydrate. So if you're a woman, that's your, you know, carbohydrate allotment for that meal. That shocks patients. I mean, a cup of pasta is not that much. You can imagine when you eat spaghetti, you probably have a lot more than a cup on your plate. So again, kind of helping patients understand that as far as portion size is really important. Okay, rice. So this is 3 servings of starch or carbohydrate. D, 2/3 cup of rice. You guys are right. That is 2 servings of carbohydrate. 1/3 cup of rice is 1 serving. 2/3 is 2 servings. And a lot of my patients love rice. So different ethnic groups eat rice, and that's their starch of choice. And so this is a real issue for them. But I tell them, you don't have to deprive yourself. Enjoy the rice. Just eat less. It's okay. So I don't want to get into that deprivation situation with them. Now, popcorn. Sometimes patients will say to me, oh my gosh, I feel so guilty I had popcorn. I'm like, popcorn's great if you get the light buttered kind and the light salt. You can have 3 cups of popcorn. That's 1 serving of carbohydrate. And so we want to, you know, evaluate what foods our patients like. If they love popcorn, I'm going to, like, go for it because that's a great choice. It has lots of fiber, and it's not going to raise your blood sugar if you keep, you know, it in the portions under control. So just kind of speaking about the diabetes educator exam, are they going to ask questions like this? Yes, they are going to. So if you're taking the education exam in the future, these are all of these questions I've been asking you are really important to know. What is a serving of starch? What are the guidelines? How much sodium? How much fiber? So these are important to know for the exam because they're important to know as we're working with patients. And if we're not a dietitian, we want to say the same thing as a dietitian is going to say to the patient so the patient doesn't get confused. We all want to be saying the same thing so that patient is getting clear and consistent messages. And so here is the serving size. This is one serving of starch, 15 grams. You can have 3 to 4 servings per meal. So as I'm explaining it, you can see how this is a more complex topic to get across to patients. So we may start with a plate method. We might start with just looking at portion control. And then as they get more sophisticated, or if they're already there, if they've done Weight Watchers, a lot of my patients who have been on Weight Watchers are like, oh, this is super easy. We're just going to evaluate. Let's see what else I have that's interesting. I think that's good. Half a cup of beans. So beans are a starch, but you can eat a half a cup for a serving, and they're filling. A small potato, your patient who says, I can't eat white foods. There it is. Small potatoes, 15 grams of carbohydrate. It's okay. Here's fruit. A lot of my patients will say, I can't eat fruit anymore. I have diabetes. Well, all of these fruits have 15 grams of carbohydrate. It's a half a banana, half a cup of juice. So this is the conversation I'm going to have about juice. So they may say, I love juice. I'm drinking juice. Well, could you cut it in half? Do half, maybe even sparkly water and half juice. And that way you're getting a little bit less carbohydrate. Or maybe they say, I don't even really need the juice. Great. Then I'd rather you eat the fruit. Eating the fruit kind of gets back to that whole mindfulness concept where you have to peel it, chop it, chew it, enjoy it. It takes a lot longer to eat one orange than it does to drink a half a cup of fruit juice. Savor it. Enjoy it. It's a treat. Look at this, strawberries. 1 1/4 cup. Oh, my gosh. Strawberries are still in season here, and I'm just loving them. Raisins. Okay, I just want to talk about hypoglycemia for a minute. Those little raisin boxes are one of my favorite treats or treatments for low blood sugar. You could carry them wherever you go. You can put them in your pocket. You can put them in your car. You can put them by your nightstand. They're easy to chew. Raisins, have them on you if you're on insulin therapy. Very important. Or you can have some of those canned juice drinks or those juice, the cardboard juice boxes too. Milk. A lot of my people don't know that milk or the people I work with has lactose, milk sugar. It will raise your blood sugar. And a lot of patients say, well, soy milk, you know, doesn't have carbohydrates. Yeah, it actually does. And then yogurt. I would just really encourage your patients to look at the labels on the yogurt. As I've mentioned, a lot of added sugars in yogurt. They want to be aware of that and count that in. And oftentimes, you know, the Greek yogurts are a better choice. They have less sugar in them, and they can feel a little more satisfying. Greek yogurt and some fresh berries. And I often, you know, a lot of my patients say, Bev, I don't have time for breakfast. I'm running out the door. Breakfast doesn't have to be fancy. It can be a fruit and some nuts. It doesn't have to be a big production. Keep it easy. Keep it fresh. Keep it simple. But just try and eat some breakfast. It's going to help you maintain blood glucose control and also help with your weight loss goals. Okay, so here's the junk food category that we know and love. And so as long as patients identify these foods and count them as part of their total carbohydrate, they can incorporate them into their meal plan. So there's just some examples there for you to take a look at. And then just to talk a little bit, so that's carbohydrates. That's one of our macronutrients. Our next macronutrient is protein. So protein, as I've mentioned, does not cause the blood sugars to go up, but protein does have calories and many times saturated fat to go along with it. So you want to choose a leaner types of protein. Lean beef, poultry, fish, egg. Use plant sources, bean, lentils, and nuts, and low-fat cheeses. And a lot of patients I talk to eat a ton of cheese. So really talking them through the cheese, and if one of your goals is weight loss, that might be one strategy is to eat less cheese. The high-fat proteins I've listed here, really trying to limit those. And then serving size is important. I like this deck of cards. That's 3 ounces, or the size of the palm of your hand, is about a serving of protein. And then when it comes to fats, I like fats in the way that they're very satiating. They make you feel full. They don't raise the blood sugar, but that doesn't mean they're free because fats have 9 calories per gram versus carbohydrates, which have 4 calories per gram. So we call fats much more calorie dense, but they do serve a purpose. We need them for hormones and for all kinds of cellular functions, and so we need fat, but we just want to watch how much we eat of it and choose these healthier fats that I have listed here. And then on the right-hand side, we've listed what is a serving size. Alcohol. So here's the deal. A lot of times patients with diabetes think they have diabetes, they can't drink alcohol. That's actually not true. And so what I say to them is, you know, do you drink alcohol? I just ask very non-judgmentally. And if they say, well, can I? And then I'm like, okay, well, how many drinks do you have a week? And that's a good starting place. That people with diabetes can, if they're a woman, have one or fewer alcoholic drinks a day, and men get 2. That's just based on general body size and body weight. And I do want to say that if you're going to choose alcohol, there are some good studies that red wine actually does not only seem to have some intestinal benefit. I didn't mean to say that. Vascular benefits and inflammation benefits. It also seems to help reduce blood sugars a little bit. So alcohol, actually a lot of patients think, well, alcohol, it's sugary, it's going to raise my blood sugar. No, alcohol lowers blood sugar. One theory is that it stimulates the pancreas to make insulin. Another theory is the liver's busy metabolizing the alcohol, so the liver doesn't release glucose. Well, whatever the fact, the main rule of thumb is if you're going to drink alcohol, you've got to eat something with it. Have alcohol with a meal, especially patients on insulin or patients with hypoglycemia unawareness. Alcohol can be really challenging, so make sure if you're going to have that drink, eat food. And then talk to your doctor and make sure it's safe, or your healthcare provider. It does cause low blood sugar and can worsen neuropathy. And if they have high triglycerides, it can crank up triglycerides. So we just want to have a conversation about alcohol and really address that. And if they're trying to lose weight, alcohol has a lot of calories. Let's just take a look at Ms. Gonzalez here. I love Ms. Gonzalez. She comes to all of my classes with me. And I think she's really an excellent example of a person who's trying hard to do her best. Let's just take a look at what she eats for breakfast. So she has 5 corn tortillas for breakfast, which is 5 servings of starch. She has 1/2 cup of beans, which is 6. She's at 6 now. And then salsa, well, that's great, right? It's tomatoes and chiles and onions and, wow, that has a lot of superfoods in it. We love it. And then she's eating egg beaters, so she's she's aware of her heart health is what I would say when a person eats egg beaters. At some point, she's worried about her cholesterol and keeping that under control. So that's what she ate for breakfast. Let's take a look at her lunch blood sugars. Well, before lunch, her blood sugars are running an average of 200, a little bit higher than target. Our before lunch target is, you know, 70 to 130. So now whenever I get a pre-lunch blood sugar, I look back to see what happened at breakfast. So what we talked about, a general goal, is 3 to 4 servings of starch per meal. And here we can see she's having 6 servings of starch, and that is probably contributing to her elevated blood sugar before lunch. So we have a choice in how we approach this with Ms. Gonzalez. And I would say the thing we don't want to say is, Ms. Gonzalez, you can only have 2 corn tortillas and 1/2 cup of beans for breakfast. That would equal 3 servings of starch. Right, because if we approach it like that, we've lost her. You know, she needs to be engaged in this conversation. So I know you guys want to do that. I'm just giving you the worst case example. So what we would say to her is, Ms. Gonzalez, you know what? I'm kind of looking at your blood sugars here, and I see that we're above target. And I'm going to tell you something really important right here. I don't use the word high. I don't say, oh, man, it's really high at lunch, because I don't want her to feel like a failure. I'm going to say your blood sugar is above target of 130 at lunch. So I've noticed you're eating 5 corn tortillas and 1/2 cup of beans. That's 6 servings of starch. And I'm thinking if you were able to cut back on your tortillas or your beans a little bit, we could get those blood sugars down at lunch. Would you be, you know, willing to try that? I don't know. Let's see what she says. And what does she say to us? Well, you know what, Bev? I can go down to 4 corn tortillas at breakfast. Is that success? You better believe that's success. So we'll say, great, I think that's a terrific idea. Let's go with that and see what happens to your lunch blood sugar. So we're doing a lot of trial and error. We're trying different things. We're involving her in this experiment because ultimately she's going to have to self-manage her diabetes. We're coaching her in that direction. And she's going to come back to us next week, or maybe we'll call her over the phone, or maybe we'll see her at the next support group, and we're going to look at her numbers again and see what happened. And so just looking at Ms. Gonzalez, her meal plan, you could say, wow, look at all the carbs she's eating. She's having sandwich, low-fat potato chips at lunch, juice, and low-fat cookies. And so you could, some people might call her non-compliant. I don't see her as non-compliant at all. I see her as needing more information. She doesn't have the information she needs to succeed. But I want to tell you something very important. Ms. Gonzalez is doing so much right. She's checking her blood sugar 4 times a day. She's writing down all of her food intake. She's keeping a very detailed logbook for us. This is awesome. And the other thing is she's trying to eat heart-healthy foods. And she's actually making some really great food choices, corn tortillas, beans. She's trying low-fat cookies. She's eating soup, low-salt soup, and barbecued meat and salad. So these are all things she's doing right. So when we work with patients around food, we want to focus on their successes and then coach them and help them make small changes to improve their blood sugars and their overall outcomes and really helping to maintain that pleasure of eating. So that's a really good example of that. And then these next few slides, I have some excellent resources for handouts and publications that you can take advantage of. As far as nutrition, there's so much good information out there. And let's just look at Mr. Jones. We've met him before, but let's talk about him a little bit more. He's a 64 years old with type 2 diabetes for 11 years, history of heart disease. We can see his labs are out of whack. His A1C is 9.3, so the target is less than 7. His HDL is below target of 40. His LDL is above target of, we want it less than 70. And he's telling you about his activity, but at the end of all of this, he tells you, my foot is hurting me. Anytime a patient with diabetes says, my foot is hurting, we need to really, pay attention to that and see what's happening. So what I'd like to do is ask you, of the following, which are some good foot care tips for Mr. Jones? What will we recommend that he does? And again, you can choose more than one answer. Well, let me rephrase that. There is one best answer here. So choose the best answer. Okay, great job, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it with you. You all are on fire today. I know I said that once, but it's worth saying again because 95% of you chose the right answer. Great job, everybody. And I do tell patients to do this. Every time you see your provider, take off your shoes and socks, show your feet. And they may say to me, well, Bev, the provider doesn't ask me to do that. I'm like, that's okay. You're going to be an advocate for yourself. And you're going to have your feet ready to go when that provider walks in. And that is a great moment because then the provider sees they're so involved and engaged in their diabetes care. I want to ask you one more question, and then we'll launch into a quick foot assessment. What are some characteristics of a high-risk foot? And you can choose more than one on this, too. Or you can choose the one best answer. All right. Thanks for voting, everybody. I really appreciate it. I'm going to go ahead and close this up. and share with all of you. So 82% of you chose the right answer again. All of these are risk factors for foot problems. Poor glycemic control, a foot deformity, previous amputation or foot ulcer is one of the biggest, because if they've already had a previous amputation or foot ulcer, we know that they have poor circulation. They probably have neuropathy. They're at risk for a future one. Vision impairment is another one. If you can't see, you're more likely to injure your foot or have an injury on your foot that you don't know about it. And people who have vision impairment from retinopathy are much more likely to have neuropathy. So I'm going to go ahead and close this, but so all of those are characteristics of a high-risk foot. And here are some vascular risk factors that we really want to be aware of with our patients. Some are modifiable and some are not. But here are some things that patients can do to improve their circulation, get the blood pressure down, watch the lipids, quit smoking, lose weight, and really look at healthy eating. I don't know if anybody can change type A personality. My main thought on type A is that they get a lot done. But type A does tend to have a little bit more stress in their life, productive stress. So let's just talk about the two types of lower extremities you might see when you work with patients. So as I'm working with patients, I'm looking at their feet. And I will tell you, during my diabetes classes, I teach four classes. On the last class for graduation, I look at everybody's feet. So I have them take off their shoes and socks, and I look at their feet, and I do a monofilament testing. I want to see what their feet look like, how they take care of them. This person has peripheral vascular disease. It's a venous disease. The blood can get to the feet, but it has a hard time getting back up to the heart. So it pools. These patients have edema. You have a hard time finding their pulse because of the fluid retention in their feet. They are more likely to get these stasis ulcers that you can see right here. So this is a high-risk foot because it's hard to fit a foot into a shoe that's going to really accommodate them. But most of them will need a specialized shoe that can accommodate this foot. But really important as far as treatment, wearing support hose, feet. Avoid constriction and make sure they have shoes that are adequately sized for their feet. On the other part of this continuum, as far as, you know, vascular disease, is arterial disease. This means the blood has a hard time getting down to the feet. So these feet oftentimes are very pale. They might look red. They're cool to touch. You might have a hard time finding pulses. This is often associated with neuropathy. And this group of patients might actually complain of intermittent claudication. That's when they walk, they get cramps in the back of their legs. They have poor oxygenation, circulation to their lower extremities. And these are very high risk of amputation if they have peripheral arterial disease plus neuropathy. Very, very high risk. So when you look at their feet, there's not much hair on them. You can't get the pulses. They're cool to touch. Sometimes they can have a waxy appearance. This is a very serious situation. Both of these lower extremities call for action. This one, we're really going to work on improving circulation. They may need to see a vascular surgeon, but exercise is going to be really important for them too, to get that circulation going. Truly, a healthy foot is a work of art. I mean, the bone structure and the vessels and the nerves and the joints and the flexibility of the foot and the arch, oh my gosh, it's really amazing. And any time that integrity of the skin is broken. So, for example, a patient says, you've heard these stories a million times. Oh, I went to the car to get something. I forgot to put my shoes on. The cement was hot and I got a blister. Well, I actually popped the blister. So when they pop the blister, then bacteria have a chance to get in. So never pop a blister because it's sterile. Once you pop it, you introduce bacteria into it. And this can actually, a callus can cause the same type of thing. A callus is hardened skin that is like a rock in your shoe, and it can damage the soft tissue underneath. And so once we have a break in the skin integrity, it can lead to infection and infection of the bone called osteomyelitis. Once you get to osteomyelitis, it's antibiotics, it's bed rest. It's really difficult for patients because they have to elevate their foot, stay off of it, bed rest, it's so, it causes a lot of depression and emotional distress with our patients. So I talk all the time about foot care, prevention of problems. And we do know that with diabetes, there's an 8-fold risk of amputation, highest than those over the age of 75. And we do know that 50% of amputations can be avoided through self-care skill, education, and early intervention. I have some good news on this slide. The rate of amputations declined by 65% from 1996 to 2008. Wow, why did that happen? It's all of our great work, our education, getting the word out, talking to patients. So that's a big, huge, phenomenal difference. And those are stats from the CDC 2012. So here's a picture of a patient that I was working with. This is when I worked at Stanford Hospital. He came into the hospital and he said, I was on micronase, I have diabetes, my doctor told me don't check my blood sugars, I don't have the bad kind. So he never checked his blood sugars. And he said, I had a callus on the bottom of my foot. So what I was doing for my callus is trimming it with a razor blade because it was bothering me. He did not know anything about foot care. Nobody taught him about how to treat a callus or what to do. So as he was trimming that callus, he got to the healthy tissue, and so with the opening for bacteria, the bacteria got in and causes huge infection and cellulitis. So he walks into our door, he's got a cellulitis, and he has to go to the operating room. And we're just praying, please let him keep his foot. He came out of the OR with a partial foot amputation, and you could see this looking at his leg. He has peripheral arterial disease. His leg is thin. It doesn't have much hair. It is kind of an ashen, purpley color. So he was a smoker, and that also contributed to his risk. He had longstanding hyperglycemia. He was smoking. He trimmed his callus with a razor. All of those came together to cause this preventable amputation. And my estimation, this amputation was 100% preventable if he would have known one thing. And that one thing is no bathroom surgery. Please share this with your patients. You have a corn, don't, you know, trim it with a razor blade. Don't use corn removers. Those Dr. Scholl's corn removers, they have salicylate. They have acid in there. That acid can burn off the corn, but it keeps burning healthy tissue, and it can leave the area exposed for bacteria. Where I work with a lot of older gentlemen, and they tell me, Bev, my toenails are so thick, I can't get through them with a regular toenail clipper, so I use a wire cutter. Great question to ask your patients, how do you trim your toenails? And then you're going to find out. You're going to hear it. I use a wire cutter. Those are usually patients who have fungus on their toenail, and the toenails are impossible to get through. So if they're in any of these situations, they need to see a podiatrist. A podiatrist, if they have Medicare, is covered benefit. So they need to get hooked up to a foot care professional who can help them and do it safely. It's so, so important. Here's all the profiles of a high-risk foot. So this is what we're going to be on the lookout for. Patients with these risk factors need extra care and education and information about how to take care of their foot. Here's some foot deformities, or a foot deformity that I see very often. It's called a claw foot. And with diabetes, with neuropathy, what can happen is the shape of the foot can change. And the tendons pull back, the Achilles tendon gets shortened, and so their foot takes on this new shape. And as you can imagine from this picture, there's a lot more rubbing that goes on in the top of the shoes. And also look at this callus formation right here. So this patient, when they walk, is distributing their weight unevenly in a way that's not mechanically helpful for the foot. So they get more calluses, much higher risk of injury. These patients really need a special shoe, and Medicare will cover a customized shoe once a year for patients with loss of protective sensation or foot deformities. So that's a benefit we want to make sure our patients know about. Very, so important. Each one of us can make a difference. Just imagine if each one of us saved 10 feet in our life, if we just taught 10 people about foot care, we would save over 1,000 limbs. Wouldn't that be exciting? And we're doing it because we see the numbers coming down. So when we look at people's feet, we want to look at their nail condition. Look in between the toes. In between the toes is a dangerous place because dead skin can accumulate there and bacteria. It can cause fissures and ulcerations. Ask who trims your nails. And if they've ever cut themselves, make sure that they get to a podiatrist to help them with nail trimming. What kind of shoes do you wear? And then if you can, have them take off your shoes and socks in front of you, and then you can see if there's any red marks where there's pressure from the shoe. The biggest cause of ulceration is too tight of shoes. Socks are very important. We want to make sure the socks aren't too tight around the calves. And also we want to make sure the socks actually offer some cushion. And they don't have a seam on top. So for patients with high-risk foot, I would definitely encourage them to get diabetes socks. They wick away moisture. You can buy them at Walmart, by the way. And they wick away moisture, and they don't have a seam on top. And then we want to evaluate our patient's ability to inspect their feet. Can they get down there and really look at their feet and see what's happening? And if not, is there anybody in their house that can help them evaluate their feet? Monofilament testing is one of the most important things that we can do. And a monofilament is just a fishing line that delivers 10 grams of linear pressure. And I wrote down here a website where you can get online today, right after we are done with this webcast, and order your own free monofilaments. It's from the Lower Extremity Amputation Prevention Program. They will send them to you because they know this can make a huge difference, and it's pennies. It costs pennies. So what you want to do, or these places that I have highlighted, is have the patient close their eyes, and then you actually bend the monofilament to make a C shape. So this, you have to bend it to make a C shape to deliver the 10 grams of pressure. So I do this on their arm first, and I say, this is what it's going to feel like. Now close your eyes and tell me when you feel it. And then I touch the bottom of their foot at random times and random locations. I don't tell them, do you feel it? Do you feel it? And have them say yes. I say, tell me when you feel it. If they don't feel a monofilament in one of these sites, and you have to avoid calluses. So you have to go above or below or around the callus. But if they can't feel the monofilament in one or more site, they have what we call loss of protective sensation. You'll see it as LOPS, loss of protective sensation. They have neuropathy. They have nerve damage in their foot. That means they are at much higher risk for having foot problems and not knowing it. So these are patients. You know, I just want to say one very important thing. Nerves are very important in your feet because they detect pressure, heat, cold, pain, injury. If your nerves are not alive or functioning well, you don't feel those things. And so you don't avoid that water that's too hot. You don't know you just stepped on a nail. You don't know your shoes are too tight. You don't know that when you put your foot into a shoe, there was a tack in there. So the patients who have loss of protective sensation need special counsel. And I'm going to share with you an article that covers a complete foot assessment, but really three most important things. Inspect and apply lotion to your feet every night before you go to bed. You can do it in the morning. I don't care. But I want you once a day, I want our patients to look at their feet, put some lotion on, touch their feet, evaluate their feet. And then do not go barefoot, even in your house. Wear shoes. You just don't know what's out there that you're going to step on. Every time you see your doctor, take off your shoes and socks and show your feet. And report any foot problems right away. This is going to save limbs. And here I have that Medicare pays for therapeutic shoes. And also on the resource page, I'm going to put an article on a complete foot assessment. I think it's actually in there already that you can take a look at. And so we're wrapping up. We have a few minutes left, but I just really want to encourage all of you as your patients come in, if they're inpatient or outpatient, to take a moment, look at their feet, ask them what they do to take care of their feet, help them identify anything that they need to change and get the resources that they need to succeed. And since we have one more minute left, I will say the following. A lot of patients ask me if it's okay if I get a pedicure done at a salon. You can get a pedicure or a manicure if you have good nerve sensation, and so you don't have any loss of protective sensation. And you need to tell the people that are taking care of you, please do not cut my cuticles, no bathroom surgery, don't dig out any ingrown toenails. Just trim the toenails straight across, you know, wash the feet, but they can't cut the feet in any way. And they need to always use sterile equipment with you. That's really, really important with the patient who goes to get the pedicure. So that's not an official guideline that I've read anywhere, but listening to several talks by podiatrists, that's kind of the general consensus. So the time is, we're reaching the end of our time, and I do want to say I'm looking forward to our next webcast. It's going to be happening on a Monday, and that's going to be at 11:30, and we're going to be talking about medication, and I'm very excited because we're going to be talking about the newly approved inhaled insulin. So I have a whole slide set I've developed for you talking about inhaled insulin, what it looks like, how to dose it, etc. So that will be our next Monday webcast, which I'll be looking forward to a lot. And, of course, if you have any questions and you can't stay, please email me. I'll answer them. But I'm going to go ahead and turn off the recording session and then stay for any questions that you might have. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off, and thank you so much for joining us today.